This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. We're going to talk about something that will help determine America's future, but Americans will not have a vote on it: the European Union. The unification of Europe is affecting America's economy and politics in ways you may not be aware of. Europe may be developing into a second superpower that could stand on equal footing with the U.S. That's the subject of the new book, The United States of Europe, The New Superpower and the End of American Supremacy. My guest is the author T.R. Reid, who you may know from his writing in The Washington Post or his commentaries on NPR's Morning Edition. He was the Post Tokyo bureau chief from 1990 to 1995, then became its London bureau chief. He's now the Post Rocky Mountain bureau chief. For Americans who haven't been following the development of the European Union that closely, can you just give us like a basic sketch of like what the structure of it is, what it means?
The European Union is a sort of a supranational pan-European government. It's 25 nations that have come together, and they've taken a lot of the governing powers and rights that individual countries have and handed them over to this central government in Brussels, so that in many ways they act like a single country. Europe has a parliament, it has a president, it has a flag, it has a national anthem, it has a standardized passport, no more border controls, a single currency, a single central bank for most of the countries. It's acting like a single nation, even though it's still made up of 25 separate nations. This unification came about as a way to prevent war. And I think the most striking thing about the EU is that it's worked. In the 70 years up to 1945, Europe had three brutal international wars on the continent. In the 60 years since, none. And there's not going to be a war between European countries. It's just not going to happen.
It may seem odd on Election Day to be talking about Europe, but you're really confident that Europe is going to have a very big effect on our future. Do you think that, as your subtitle implies, that Europe will be eclipsing our stature as a superpower?
Well, that's certainly what the Europeans hope. And when I first started following this 4 or 5 years ago, I laughed at them. I was bored at EU summits. They stood up and said, "We're building a new superpower. Look out, America." But, Terry, let's look at the numbers. They have more people. They have more money. They have vastly more trade than we do. They have more votes than the United States on every international organization. They don't have more military power. They don't want it. They're spending that money on this lavish welfare state of theirs. And they really want to stand up to America to rank as a superpower next to us. They're driving for this. If you look at recent polls, 78-80% of the European people say they want Europe to be a superpower equal to America, and 70% say they're going to get there pretty quickly, or they've gotten there already, some think.
What kind of answer to the United States power would Europe want to be? Like, in what case, in what kinds of issues does it want to either balance us or veto us?
Well, for example, Europe wants to be the center of global antitrust law, international trade and antitrust law. They don't want to follow Washington's lead, and this is why they have stuck it to big American companies like Microsoft and General Electric by imposing their rules. And, you know, American companies don't particularly like it when the antitrust czar of Europe tells them they told Microsoft to rewrite Windows. They don't like it, but they can't say no, because it's the biggest market in the world now. The European Union, with 25 nations and about 500 million people, is a bigger market than the United States. It's a bigger market than Japan. American companies can't say no anymore.
Let's look at the European Union and the invasion of Iraq. England was with the United States on that. Most of the European countries were not, or at least even those who were, didn't seem to be that strongly behind the U.S. Excuse me for speaking in big generalizations here. But how did the fact that Europe is now united in the European Union affect, if at all, how different countries took their positions on Iraq?
A key factor is that Europe gives away a lot more foreign aid than the United States does, the EU and the European countries. They give it to more countries. And so at any given time, if you take the European members of the UN Security Council and the countries that happen to be on the Security Council that are receiving most of their aid from the EU, This gives them a lot of clout in the United Nations, and this is the reason that President Bush couldn't pass his second resolution in the Security Council to go to war in Iraq. We blamed the French and the Russians, but as a matter of fact, we couldn't get anywhere near the 9 votes needed to pass something out of the Security Council because, except for Britain, the EU members were strongly opposed, and the countries receiving aid and dependent on the EU were therefore opposed. That amounts to power. If you look at the World Trade Organization, if you look at the Kyoto Accord Organization, the vote on the International Criminal Court, the EU, although it acts as one country in many ways, it keeps its 25 separate votes in all those organizations. Plus, it gives aid around the world to countries that it can then lobby for. So the EU and its power to stand up to the United States and these international organizations is making it harder for us to achieve things. You know, this, I'll give you an example. The last big bill that came out of Congress, this massive tax bill where they gave away bennies to lots of American corporations. Remember that?
Yeah.
That vote was forced on us by the World Trade Organization. We had this basically tax subsidy for American exporters that had been in place for 25 years. The Japanese and the Chinese wrote political diplomatic letters saying, come on, please stop. The EU went to the World Trade Organization, where they control most votes, and got the World Trade Organization to issue sanctions against the United States. Hundreds of millions of dollars a year is in tariffs if we didn't change this law. And the EU was very blunt about it. The EU trade commissioner said, what we're trying to do here is repeal a U.S. law. Does the European Union have the right to repeal U.S. laws? Well, I'll tell you what the Speaker of the House, Dennis Hastert, said. I love this. He said, my gut feeling is we fought a revolution 230 years ago to stop Europeans from telling us what we tax in this country. But the fact is, we have to pass this bill. The EU has a sword over our head. We don't like it, but we have to do what the Europeans are telling us to do. What I'm arguing in this book is that's a kind of global power. It's not military power, but it's power that forced the United States to do something we didn't want to do at great expense. That's power, isn't it?
You say in your book that anybody who doesn't get how powerful the European Union is should learn the lesson that Jack Welch, the former head of GE, learned when he tried to buy Honeywell. And this was a deal that was approved in the United States. It passed muster in terms of antitrust stuff in the U.S. Justice Department, but it didn't pass the standards of the European Union. Why not?
That's exactly right. It was the biggest industrial merger in history, a $45 billion deal. And Jack Welch came up with this idea just at the beginning of the Bush administration. This is a Republican administration, you know, favorable towards business. And that deal just sailed through our antitrust department. But Europe has one single antitrust czar for 25 countries, and he held it up. He has, as I said earlier, he doesn't want to follow American antitrust rules. The fact that our Justice Department approved it didn't matter to him. And I think it's very clear that Jack Welch and GE never saw this coming. In fact, Jack Welch said, it never occurred to me that the European Union might say no. There's this great moment when Jack Welch finally goes over to Europe to see Mario Monti, the antitrust czar, decides to go to lunch with him because, you know, Welch is absolutely charming. Nobody can resist him. He goes into the restaurant and sticks out his hand and says, Mario, Jack. And Monty says, Mr. Welch, we have a regulatory proceeding underway. I believe you should refer to me as Senior Monty. And I think at that point, Welch knew he had a big problem. Europe shot it down. Welch had to come home to his board of directors and say, we can't do this $45 billion merger because Europe said no. The U.S. Treasury Secretary said, wait a minute, Europe has no right to tell two American countries. And, you know, Jack Welch is a realist. He said, yeah, they have the right because they're a bigger market than Japan or the United States. We have to sell product there, so we have to follow their law. Now, here's the point. If you look at what Jack Welch spent on that merger, he spent about $50 million on antitrust lawyers and another $25 or $30 million on investment bankers, $75 million to learn this lesson about the power of the EU. This is my big argument. For $24.95, you can learn the same argument from my book.
That's
we're talking
really
bargain here.
So, I mean, I guess what you're saying is, like, what's the point of a merger like this if you can't sell to the European Union? I mean, that's a huge market. And no one can afford to miss it.
That's exactly right. They now have the market power. As a matter of fact, the EU sets most of the commercial rules that govern international trade. I don't know if you ever buy bourbon. I buy Kentucky bourbon, and I'm so old that I can remember when you bought it as a fifth. You bought it as a quart or a fifth of a gallon. Today, you buy a bottle of Kentucky bourbon, and it's 70 centiliters. Do you think Americans stormed the liquor stores demanding to buy their bourbon in centiliters? No, I don't think so. It's because the EU told them to do it, and American companies have to follow these rules because it's such a massive market.
Why is it that in an era when America is becoming more deregulated, that Europe is becoming more regulated?
They believe in regulation. They like government better than we do. I don't think there's any doubt about that. And when you ask them about it, they have their success stories. I'll give you a good example. In the late 1980s, early 90s, when cell phones were starting to catch on in Europe and the United States was in a deregulatory mode, and we had several different standards. Nobody was going to impose a standard on the industry. They could set up their own standards. Europe was in this unifying mindset, this EU mindset, and they set a single standard for all of Europe. As it turned out, Americans were not happy with the fact that the cell phone you bought in Arizona wouldn't work in Massachusetts, whereas in Europe, the same cell phone, you could buy it in Estonia and use it in Portugal. You could use it anywhere. Finally, eventually, the European standard moved all over the world, and guess what? A couple of European companies using this standard grabbed on and took hold of the cell phone industry. Nokia passed Motorola, become the number one cell phone company in the world. A network called Vodafone, which now owns Verizon, is the biggest cell phone network operator in the world, European company. And that's, the Europeans will tell you, that's because they standardize. It's because they have this union that sets single rules. So they just like regulation. They like rules better than we do.
If you're just joining us, my guest is T.R. Reid, and he's the Rocky Mountain Bureau Chief for The Washington Post, the former Tokyo and London Bureau Chief for The Washington Post. While he was the London Bureau Chief, he chronicled the rise of the European Union, and that's the subject of his new book, which is called The United States of Europe, The New Superpower and the End of American Supremacy. Let's take a short break here, and then we'll talk some more about the EU. This is Fresh Air. My guest is T.R. Reid, and he's the former Tokyo Bureau Chief and former London Bureau Chief for The Washington Post. He's now the Rocky Mountain Bureau Chief. His new book is called The United States of Europe, and it's about the European Union. It's subtitled The New Superpower and the End of American Supremacy. There's a lot of companies that we may think of as being American-owned companies that are really owned by European companies. Would you do the roll call for us?
Yeah, I talk in my book about this typical American couple who decide to go for a weekend vacation. They don't have enough cash, so they go down to Household Finance in the local mall and borrow the money. They get in their Jeep. They gas up at an Amoco station. They stop at Dunkin' Donuts for breakfast. They put a Dave Matthews CD in the stereo. They're both watching their weight, so they have a super slim fast for lunch. Spend the night at a Holiday Inn. Give their dog some Alpo. And have a Miller Lite and smoke some Lucky Strikes, read a new book from the Literary Guild and pop some pay-per-view and the TV and call somebody on their Verizon phone. Classic American vacation, and every company I've just named is owned by Europeans. You know, the Jeep is owned by Daimler Chrysler. Amoco, the American oil company, is now owned by British Petroleum. Lucky Strikes is British American Tobacco. That's a British company. You just go down the list, Dove soap, Vaseline, Pennzoil, Quaker State Motor Oil. Doesn't that sound American to you? is owned by a Dutch company, Bird's Eye, the Los Angeles Dodgers, the Chicago Sun-Times, Brooks Brothers, Sunglass Hut, even Mott's Apple Pie. It's about as American as you can get, is owned by a British company. The American Heritage Dictionary is published by Vivendi, a French firm. The U.S. Shoe Corporation belongs to the Italians.
When the Japanese bought a lot of American companies and American real estate in the 80s, including Sony and Rockefeller Center, there was a lot of concern. You know, are the Japanese buying up America? What will this mean for our future? Do you think we hear the same concerns expressed about European companies that have bought American companies?
Yeah, great question. No, we don't. I don't think most Americans know if they stay a Holiday Inn, they're staying in a European company's hotel. I don't think they know that. And I don't think they care. I think for a couple of reasons. In the first place, I think a lot of Americans understand it's a good thing if the Europeans want to take their money and invest it in our economy. It creates jobs. That's good. You know, build factories, build hotels here. We like that. The other thing is, and certainly the Japanese and the Chinese will tell you this, they argue that Americans don't seem to mind if blue-eyed Germans or Dutchmen buy our buildings and our factories, and they did mind when Japanese bought them. There was something wrong with it. They say it's racism. I don't know that that's true, but certainly in Japan, they've noticed this difference. Whenever I'm over there, people talk about it. The downside of it is that, you know, when these European companies get a huge interest in our economy and our industry, millions and millions of Americans work for European companies now. In America, you can lay people off. We allow that. In most European countries, it's against the law to downsize. You can't lay people off. And I'll give you a good example. Diageo is a British company that owned Burger King. They were losing money. They had to do something about their stock price. So you know what they did? They laid off 8,000 Burger King workers in America. They didn't lay anybody off at their European subsidiaries because they weren't allowed to. So it's a good thing that Europeans want to invest in our economy. It's desirable in many ways, but there is a kick to it too, because when the downside comes, they're going to do it in their American subsidiary, not at home.
Now, you've said that, you know, the EU isn't really interested in becoming a military superpower, and they don't really have the troops or the arms to do that. So certainly that will be something that it does not challenge the United States on, at least not in the near future.
Yes.
But you also said it doesn't seem to want to have that military superpower kind of role. What is its philosophy of what kind of military it wants or needs?
I think its military is pretty much a defense of the homeland, defense of Europe kind of military. If you look, Terry, at the reason there's an EU in the first place, it's pretty noble. It started after World War II. They had three wars going back to the Franco-Prussian War in about 70 years that killed about 100 million Europeans. And they said, my God, we're going to keep doing this. There's going to be another war on the continent unless we change. And the whole mindset in Europe that's driving the European Union is the sense that we've got to work together. We're going to be multinational. We're going to cede sovereignty to a central governing unit that we all share, and therefore we're not going to fight each other. The whole mindset of the continent is moving away from military solutions, not only at home, but around the world. That's why they didn't want to go to war in Iraq. And therefore, if you're in that mindset, military is kind of a costly anachronism. Why pour money into it? They'd much rather pour money into their free health care or their free college education or the money they pay young mothers to stay home with the children. They'd much prefer to spend the money on the welfare state, and fortunately for them, there's a sugar daddy in the world that's willing to defend them militarily. That's the United States. As long as we keep doing this, they don't need a big military, and they can afford to pour that money into the welfare state instead.
Now, how has funding anti-terrorism tactics affected Europe's sense of its own security and its military needs?
Europe's very scared about terrorism. They had terrorism, you know, domestic terrorism before 9/11, 2001, and they were terrified by what happened to our country, and they've been worried about it. If you look at the response, the Europeans are the only place, European countries, the only place where members of Al-Qaeda have been convicted and sent to jail. They've been quite serious about it, and they are spending money and police work on it, but I don't think they, and they did take a pretty big part in Afghanistan. I have to say half the casualties and half the cost in Afghanistan has been borne by the Europeans because they saw that as a threat to themselves. But basically, the notion that you're going to go around the world sending troops in to fight terrorism wherever it may be is not a European notion. They're going to fight it at home. They're going to try to do it through police work and through better security at home. And they just don't accept the military solution to this problem because I think the mindset in Europe, as I said, is not to look for military solutions to global problems.
T.R. Reid is the author of the new book, The United States of Europe. He's worked as the Washington Post bureau chief in London and Tokyo and is now the paper's Rocky Mountain bureau chief. He'll be back in the second half of the show. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross, back with T.R. Reid, author of a new book about the European Union and its impact on the U.S. It's called The United States of Europe, The New Superpower and the End of American Supremacy. Reid chronicled the rise of the EU while he served as the Washington Post London bureau chief. He's now the Post's Rocky Mountain bureau chief and a commentator on NPR's Morning Edition. When we left off, we were talking about why European countries' investment in the military is relatively small compared to the U.S. Since the European Union is not spending that much money on the military, and they are spending it on certain social and economic needs, their model of what the government is supposed to be doing for its people is becoming, I think, pretty different from the American model. Because in America, we're at a time of cutbacks in social services and increasing amount of money toward military, such as the war in Iraq. Could you compare the two different philosophies now about, the social services versus military?
Yeah. I think the key way to wrap this up is the term welfare state. In the United States, welfare state is kind of an epithet. It's a nasty phrase that that politicians throw at some other politician who's trying to waste money on the poor. In all over Europe, welfare state is a term of pride. They love their welfare state, and they constantly say that their welfare state, this rich pension system, free medical system, free college tuition, the payments they make to mothers to stay home with their babies. You know, if you have a baby in Norway, the government hires you at your old salary, whatever you were earning on the job, to stay home and raise your baby for a year, and they pay you the same pay, and then they guarantee your job back when you want to go back to work. That kind of thing is what they call the welfare state, and they're very proud of it. I remember I went to a demonstration at Oxford University when Tony Blair had this shocking notion. Are you ready for this? He had this idea that people should pay for college education. You know, you can get a degree at Oxford now. He's actually raised the price of a degree at Oxford to about $5,000 a year. You'd pay $40 at Harvard. This is pretty much of a bargain. But I went to a demo there, and the kids were all screaming and ranting and raving, you know, bed sheets flying from the windows. And the student said, education must be free. Free education is a crucial part of our beloved welfare state. And I wrote in the Washington Post, I think that phrase, our beloved welfare state, really captures it. They believe that government should be there to make things comfortable for you. And to me, that's a fundamental difference in worldview between our country and theirs. Of course, as I say, it's easier for them because they're not paying all this money for this huge military, and therefore they have the money left over to let kids go to college for free.
And they also have a different taxing system. Talk about the value-added tax that you paid when you were based in London.
Yeah, I was so stunned by that. I don't know. I'm sure many of your listeners have been to London. If you've been to London or lived in Britain, everything is outrageously expensive, two or three times what you would pay here. And then on top of this huge price, they throw a 17.5% sales tax on everything. 17.5%, you know, that's way over double what I'm paying here in Colorado. I thought it was outrageous. And my wife and I kept saying, why do they put up with this? Why do they stand for this? And then I'll tell you what happened. About a week after we arrived in London, one of my daughters woke up and her ear was about the size of a golf ball, bright red, just full of pain. We had no idea what to do. We'd been there 5 days. We had no doctor or anything. We jumped out and got in a cab. The guy took us to an emergency room. It's kind of a grody old hospital, you know, the paint was chipping and everything, but the emergency room was fine. The nurse took us in. A few minutes later, a doctor saw my daughter. He gave her a lecture about cleaning her pierced earrings, you know, got the pus out of there. She felt great. Everybody was happy. I pulled out my checkbook to pay the bill. It's an emergency ward, right? They cost money. And the nurse says, "You may put away your checks. We don't pay for medical care in this country." And my wife turned to me and said, "There's why we're paying the 17.5%.
Why is the main taxing system this value-added tax, this 17.5% sales tax in England and a similar tax in most of the other European countries? Why the emphasis on that as opposed to income tax, estate tax, property taxes?
Yeah, they do have all that range of progressive taxes that we do, income, property taxes, corporate taxes. And they do, frankly, soak the rich. The particularly the estate tax rates in Europe are pretty high. But for the universally available services, like the payment to new parents or the pensions or the unemployment rates and particularly health care, everybody gets those. There's nobody in any European country who's not covered. They're all covered. And they think everybody should pay for them. And that's why they have these high sales tax rates, because everybody pays sales taxes. There's a notion of equity there. Everybody's going to benefit from our healthcare system, so everybody ought to pay for it. Even if you don't have enough income to pay tax, pay for it when you buy things. That's the mindset.
Tia Reid is my guest. He's the Washington Post Rocky Mountain bureau chief, the former London bureau chief. And while he was based in London, he followed the rise of the European Union. And that's the subject of his new book, The United States of Europe, The New Superpower and the End of American Supremacy. I'm interested in religion in the new Europe. In the United States, like the evangelical vote has become so important. You know, religion was such a big issue, particularly in the Bush campaign. And, you know, faith-based initiatives. There's so much in the United States that seems to be revolving in one way or another around faith. Is there any similar phenomenon in Europe?
No, the opposite. I gave a lot of attention to this in my book because it's so striking. If you look at Europe, it's the home of just about every major Christian denomination. It's a key center of Jewish life and culture, huge Muslim population, and yet Europeans, and particularly Generation E, the younger people I mentioned, have basically put religion out of their life. I went to a beautiful church in Stockholm. Beautiful church, seated, beautiful old cathedral, fantastic organ, 900 seats, and there were maybe 8 or 9 people in there for Sunday Mass. And I said to the priest, "What's going on?" And he said, "Yeah, 9, 10, that's about what we get." He said, "People have so much forgotten what going to church means that they call him up and say, 'Hey, Father, what day is Mass?'" He says, "Sunday morning." And they say, "Do I need a reservation?" I mean, they just don't know. In Holland, the Church of Holland is selling its old churches for apartment buildings. Religion is just not an important part of European life. And if you're sitting with a bunch of particularly college-educated Europeans watching an American president on TV, you know, the American president, no matter who he is, always says, "God bless America" at the end. And they all kind of titter. They give this kind of superior laugh. "Oh, my God, they're so backwards in that country," kind of thing, you know.
In the United States, religion is often tied to certain moral arguments, for instance, against abortion, against homosexuality, against gay marriage. So is there a counterpart in Europe?
Yeah, there are definitely moral movements in Europe. They're not so much religiously driven, but for example, no country in the European Union, no country in Europe can have the death penalty. They consider it barbaric. You can't be a member of the European Union if you have the death penalty. And it's one of their big complaints against Americans that we do this. In fact, they think we're executing thousands of people a year because every time we execute 85 to 100 people a year in this country. Every time we do it, it makes huge headlines in the European papers and all of them. So they think it happens all the time here. Another place where the morality shows up, interestingly, is in their attitudes towards drug use. Almost all the European countries have decriminalized drug use. They don't think it should be treated as a crime. should be treated as a health problem, as a social problem, and that's how they treat it. And they make this argument on moral grounds. If you send these people to prison, they're going to use more drugs. We're failing them. So as a moral, we have a moral obligation to cure them, not to treat them as criminals. That too, even though they don't have the religious basis, they definitely have a political movements driven by moral imperatives.
You write in your book that in Belgium and the Netherlands, there's full legal recognition of gay marriage, and most other European countries have authorized civil ceremonies for gay and lesbian couples. But in the United States, President Bush has been supporting a constitutional amendment that would outlaw gay marriage. It's a really big cultural difference. Do you have a sense of what they make in England of the political anti-gay rights movement in the United States?
As I said, I think they're quite cynical about the notion of bringing perceived religious beliefs into the political world. It's just not thinkable that Tony Blair would ever stand up at the end of a speech and say, "God bless Britain." It just couldn't happen. They'd laugh him off the stage if he did. And so they generally see this as a political ploy, not so much as some kind of morally driven imperative on the president's part. They see this as an appeal to the Christian right. I think they're very pleased that they no longer have religiously oriented political parties. As I say, religion doesn't matter much in European countries. An interesting sidelight of people not going to churches, they don't get married anymore either. I don't know if you know this, but if you look at the European rates of unmarried motherhood, they're the highest in the world. This is not because they have single mothers. It's that the mom and dad are living there with the kids. They just never bothered to get married because in many European countries, people don't get married anymore. Most of them now have some kind of legal civil union system. It wasn't created to accommodate gay marriages. It was created for ordinary heterosexual couples, but gay couples can take advantage of the same law.
My guest is T.R. Reid of The Washington Post. His new book is called The United States of Europe. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is T.R. Reid, and he's currently the Rocky Mountain Bureau Chief of The Washington Post. He's the former London Bureau Chief, and his new book is about the European Union. It's called The United States of Europe, The New Superpower, and the End of American Supremacy. After France opposed the U.S. at the U.N. right before we went into Iraq, this whole movement started in the United States of just like mocking the French. So you didn't call them French fries. If you felt this way, you call them freedom fries. And, you know, people were boycotting French cheeses and French wines. And if you call somebody French or say that they have like French blood, that was in some circles like a terrible insult.
You remember John Kerry looks like a Frenchman? You remember
precisely.
That terrible slur?
Precisely. Yeah. So what do you, I don't know when the last time you were in France was, but do you have any sense of what the people in France are making of all of this?
There are two things about this. In the first place, they're mad about us for dumping on France. You know, a lot of the world opposed the Iraq war. They don't think it's fair for us to stick it just to France. And the other thing, I don't think it's an insult to them to stop calling French fries, because they think the greasy, big, fat potato that's sold in America is nothing they would ever touch anyway. I don't know if you've ever had frites from a friterie on the street in Paris, but they're really good. They're crisp and fresh, and they're nothing like American French fries. So it's almost an insult to the French to call what we call a French fry, as far as they're concerned. I'll tell you the most interesting thing was the columnist from Le Monde, Mark Roche, a very smart guy, a good friend of mine. I asked him, does it bother you that Americans won't buy French wine anymore? And here's what he said. He said, if Americans are stupid enough to give up wonderful wines and delicious cheese, that's their problem. In France, we know that such delights make life worth living. But I think what they understand is, particularly in Britain, it was very politically useful for Tony Blair to blame the French, because you can always get the Brits fired up about the frogs.
How do you think the American presidential race is being seen across Europe?
Let's be totally frank about it. The vast majority of Europeans despise George W. Bush. I think he's probably the least popular American president in Europe in the last 50, 60, 70 years. Europeans liked Reagan. They found him charming and likable just like we did. They liked Clinton. He paid attention to Europe. They liked him. They liked his George Bush Sr. because he was an internationalist who cared about Europe. Boy, they really despise Bush. They're, you know, they kind of look at you and say, how did you elect this guy kind of thing. So I would say that even in the countries that are supporting us in the Iraq war, Spain, Poland, and Britain, for example, vast majorities of the population there are against the war and against Bush. I have a lot in my book about this kind of national, international, European pastime of America bashing, but the fact is a lot of it is Bush bashing. They really like our country and they like our culture, but they really get off on trashing George W. Bush. He's extremely unpopular. So if they could vote, John Kerry would win in a walk.
What makes Bush so unpopular besides the Iraq War?
The death penalty is a key factor. When he became president, I talked to the justice minister of France, and I said, what do you know about our new president? I mean, this is a guy, he'd been a fighter pilot, he'd been an oil man, he'd owned, run a big company, he was governor of a state that's bigger than many European countries. And I said to the justice minister, what do you know about our new president? And he said, I know he signed 153 death warrants when he was governor. That's all they knew. So they don't like that. They don't like the swagger and the cowboy boots. And they particularly don't like, if you're not with us, you're against us. They particularly don't like voting against the Kyoto Accords or the International Criminal Court on the grounds that it's bad for America. That's not supposed to be the measure to them. The measure is whether it's better for the whole world. That's the test they should have used. And Bush was just too blunt. He wasn't diplomatic enough. There's another mistake that President Bush and his administration made repeatedly, and that is they tried to intrude on EU decisions. And boy, the European Union is not going to stand for that. President Bush, when he was trying to convince the Turks to join us in Iraq, you remember that?
Yeah.
To kind of win favor with Turkey, he called leaders of the EU and said, why don't you let Turkey into the EU? And this absolutely backfired because the one thing the EU is not going to let Washington tell them is who can be members of their club. That's for them to decide. And I don't think the Bush people ever quite figured out that that kind of pressure, which they tried to bring all the time, was counterproductive.
What were some of the differences for you traveling and making purchases in the new European Union as opposed to when you were in Europe and it was different countries without the EU?
Well, for me, as a guy who traveled around a lot, it's a lot better. I'll tell you, every time I ever went to Portugal, I came home with just a suitcase full of junk. And the reason was I'd get back to the airport with all these escudos in my pocket. I'm never going to use them again until I come back to Portugal. So I'd buy junk at the airport. I had junk from every country in Europe in my home. Now, when I go to Portugal, I'm spending euros. When I cross the border to Spain or go over to Germany, I'm going to use the same money. I have vastly better. Travel is much easier. As I said, I drove from the Arctic Circle to the Mediterranean. I went through 8 countries, never saw a border guard, never changed money. Traveler is much simpler. And interestingly, in Europe today, although I don't think many Americans realize this, there is emerging a single language.
What is it?
English. Everybody in Europe learns English. And the people who call themselves Generation E, these are Europeans from about age 18 to 40 or so. These are people who are, you know, they're born in Prague, they're educated in Paris, they land a job in Edinburgh, and then they take a new job in Rome. And they feel it is their birthright to live and work and vote, frankly, travel anywhere they want in Europe. These people are Europeans. They may be from Toledo or Oslo, but they're Europeans from Oslo. They're not Norwegians so much anymore. They're Europeans who live in Norway or were born in Norway. I think that's a really striking change, and these people particularly talk to each other in English. In fact, most pan-European countries now have enforced English as the standard corporate language, even in France. You know they hate that.
You know, the place where you lived mostly in Europe, London, isn't using the euro. They're still using the pound. So, there's things that England has resisted the European Union on. So is England still kind of set apart, and are there drawbacks to that?
Yeah, the Brits have this love-hate relationship with the EU. They can't quite figure it out. Tony Blair says Britain should be at the very heart of Europe, but the Brits still haven't joined the euro. They hold back quite a bit. It's funny because one of the visionaries, probably the leading visionary who formed the United States of Europe, was Winston Churchill, the British leader. And the Brits have played an important role all the way through. But today in Britain, man, they're just not sure. Some people want to be the 51st state of the United States. Some want to be a key player in Europe. And they're really split on this. It's a schizoid country on this point.
Well, T.R. Reid, thanks so much for talking with us.
Delighted. I love your show. I'm delighted to be on it.
T.R. Reid is the author of The United States of Europe. He's the Washington Post's former London bureau chief and is now the paper's Rocky Mountain bureau chief.